Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Whitney Asset Management's Economic Update Call. The information and opinions expressed on this call are those of the individuals who made the statement and do not necessarily reflect the policies, views, opinions, and positions of Hancock Whitney Bank. Hancock Whitney makes no representation as to the accuracy, completeness, timeliness, suitability, or validity of any of the information presented. This information is general in nature and is provided for educational purposes only. Information provided and statements made should not be relied on or interpreted as accounting, financial planning, investment, legal, or tax advice. Hancock Whitney Bank encourages you to consult a professional for advice applicable to your specific situation. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Officer David Lundgren, who will serve as the moderator, Chief Investment Strategist Paul Teton, and Investment Directors Richard Chauvin, Jeffrey Tangus, and Greg Helewski. And with that, I'll pass it on to David.
Great. Thank you, Ashley. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to change up the format of the call just a little bit. This month, the coronavirus really consumed headlines, not of only financial news outlets, but also regular news as well. And what we want to do today is just spend a little time in the beginning of the call exploring the impacts of this deadly virus. And let me say that we're very aware of the human tragedy associated with this virus. But feel like it's our responsibility, our job, at least for purposes of the call, to really focus on the market and economic impacts of the virus. So if we're speaking about it in matter-of-fact terms, I just want to make sure everybody's aware that we're keenly aware of the other side of this event. So with that, we're going to start with you, Richard. And I saw a headline this morning. It looks like that the latest number of cases reported is up over 20,000. What are you hearing? What can you tell us about where we are from the coronavirus and the spread of the disease to this point?
Thank you, Dave. Yes, every day the count of cases and the count of people dying from the virus has gone up. The Tuesday reports that I saw were 20,600 cases, up over 3,000 from the prior day. The number of deaths is now stated to be 425. That's up from 362 the prior day. That's been climbing, pretty steadily, as I said, but a couple things to point out there. Most of these cases, matter of fact, of the 425, 414 of them are in the Hubei province, where the virus was believed or known to have started at this animal and meat market and outdoor market in China, which are these markets are apparently very common. I think 49 original cases started there. They think that's the origination point, but I'll talk more about that in a minute. First of all, it's useful to point out in terms of the dealing with the fear that this virus has caused around the world, and particularly in China, that the mortality rate is about 2%, which is quite low for compared to other outbreaks of viruses. And for example, the SARS virus, which is often used for comparison purposes here, which occurred in 2002, 2003, and that was also originated in China. That resulted in over 800 deaths worldwide. So this one's up to almost half of that, about half of that. But it had a death rate of about 9%, so substantially more lethal than this current virus seems to be. And another point of just keeping things in some perspective, because this obviously has gotten, as you said, lots of news attention. The current flu season, which of course happens every year, has had 19 million cases in the United States, 180,000 hospitalizations, and about 10,000 deaths. So obviously much, much larger in impact in the United States in particular, but doesn't get the degree of news flow that the virus does. And I think a lot of that, the reason for that is because of the way this virus originated and that it probably came from some animals. And the latest research seems to be that it came from bats because I was reading a report just recently that there's a virology lab in Wuhan province where this virus started, and it seems to be genetically almost identical to a bat virus that they've studied there. So the latest research is that this likely originally came from bats in southern China. So this virus has had obviously a lot of economic impact. There's been border closings in Russia, Hong Kong. Part of China's governing system has demanded complete closures of the checkpoints with China, but there's still a couple of them that are still open, and hospital workers are protesting and even striking over that. They want those borders closed. The United States has not been willing to let in citizens from China. And that's happening around the world in an effort to try to contain this flow of the transmission of the disease. And I'll point out that the World Health Organization, which is sort of the official keeper of whether this of the severity of these kinds of outbreaks, has declared a World Health Organization epidemics, but not a pandemic. A pandemic is defined as an outbreak that covers a wide geographic area and a high percentage of the population in that area. That has not been declared. They do not consider it a pandemic, and they still have not recommended complete travel restrictions. So the World Health Organization tends to kind of play this down in terms of its severity, even though it gets a lot of attention. And with that, Dave, I was going to let Paul Teaton talk about the economic impacts.
Thank you, Richard. And Paul, you know, closed borders and I guess people unwilling to travel, none of that can be good from an economic standpoint. What do we feel like the economic impact, and maybe start with the economic impact specific to China and then from a global perspective? Give us some insights on that, if you could.
Sure, Dave. Good morning. kind of the bottom line is we're reading estimates that the hit to Chinese growth will be pretty significant. They have been running at around a 6% rate of real GDP growth for the last few years. That's down from 12 prior to the 2008 crisis. And so really quite a slowdown already by their standards for keeping several hundred million people working and employed and productive. But anyway, the expectation is that growth will probably slip to about a 4.5% rate. There's no clear consensus of how long that will last, maybe just a quarter or so, and then sort of start to firm up is the general feeling. Globally, last year, the IMF reported that their estimates of global growth, real GDP, were running about 3% rates, more or less year-to-year rates, and that's considered a problematic level of growth and close to stall speed and recessionary conditions in a lot of places. Pretty slow growth for the global economy. So the expectations were that the Phase One trade agreement would have a positive impact on capital investment planning and could result in an acceleration of global growth up to around 3.5%, so about a 0.5% boost to growth from that confidence boost associated with Phase One trade agreement. Well, the timing of this coronavirus is extremely bad in that context, in that it is a depressant of business confidence. And so I think that, global supply chains, which many are anchored in China, were already disturbed from the tariffs and a barrage of criticism of Chinese practices involving cyber espionage and national security risks associated with sourcing sensitive communications and imaging equipment there. So this is the last thing they need is to shake confidence further on sourcing supply chains in China. So that part is sort of unknown. It's sort of an unknown negative out there, but the timing is bad for China and really not helpful to global growth at all. Don't see a lot of impact directly for the U.S. at this point.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Greg, I guess from a stock market perspective, the month of January started off pretty solid, really, the first 2 weeks of the month. Saw some pretty good returns across many different market capitalizations as well as geographies. And then I guess as news broke on this and as it, I guess, fears got a little bit more raised. We saw some pretty difficult markets, really no place to hide. Just talk a little bit about the stock market impact, if you could.
Sure. I was on a call late yesterday afternoon, and I mentioned the three things driving the market last month were coronavirus. But, yeah, as you said, the markets were consumed, the news cycle was consumed by the coronavirus situation. You know, major concerns, uncertainty how far it might progress, what the implications might be for global economic growth. We saw stocks sell off, bonds rallied as investors sought out more defensive areas of the market, as you would suspect. I think the actual utilities were probably the best performing sector last month. But the stock sell-off really started around, as you said, mid-January. By then, I think the S&P was up a little over 3%, and over the subsequent 2 weeks, it wiped out the gains that we had generated in the first half of the month. And, of course, if you look at the VIX, volatility spiked up during the month to at least three times as much or four times. But the S&P lost about 2% in just last week. Small cap stocks had a little tougher time, and they were down about 3.5%. And really, the thing is that when it looked like the economic slowdown, you know, there were some indications that perhaps we finally bottomed out and we might be taking a turn upward. The coronavirus story hit, which of course is another, you know, out of the blue. No one expected that. China accounts for about one-third of global growth, so a prolonged impact would slow growth in China, which would have repercussions globally. Again, the main driver is uncertainty, and markets, of course, hate uncertainty. If the virus continues to spread and treatment can't be found, it will impact global trade. If China slows down, I was looking at an article in the Financial Times, and they were looking at different countries in terms of a 1% reduction in growth rate in China. And the greatest impacts actually will occur in the Asian countries that have high percentages of exposure to China. And the top ones would be South Korea, Hong Kong, Thailand, Malaysia. Those are, you know, some of the really highly leveraged to trade with China. The U.S. is actually sitting in a pretty good place. Our impact would be quite minimal. Germany, Russia are at about the middle of that pack. Again, this is one of those unexpected developments that are somewhat unquantifiable at the moment, so we'll just need to be patient until some resolution or progress can be made in containment and in treatment. Just looking forward, at least in the near future, probably expect more volatility and some kind of, like I said, quantifiable remedy can occur.
All right. Thanks, Greg. Well, Jeff, you know, I guess when fear is high, treasuries and bonds are a normal place that people seek refuge in, and definitely the case in January. So maybe just bring us up to date on the bond market and see, you know, maybe a little comment on how the Fed may factor into this, if you could.
Sure, Dave. Be happy to. That's right. The treasuries are always the mirror image of what's going on in the stock market. The risk-off tone that took over with the coronavirus news really was generated a flight to quality, primarily into treasuries. We saw corporate bonds and high-yield bond prices become a little weaker in the process. The rally in Treasury bond prices certainly was part of a safe haven move in the marketplace, but also it's a deflation hedge move for people around the world. The economic uncertainty brings concerns about whether the global economy tips over and brings back inflation, and that causes people to rush in and buy bonds, especially longer-term bonds, which had a tremendous rally. We saw the 30-year Treasury bond dip below 2% at one point last week. So it's a powerful rally, and it's not unlike what we saw back in 2002-2003 during the SARS virus situation. So the rates have ticked down dramatically since the first of the year. As we sit here today, the 10-year is down about 34 basis points. At one point, it was down about 42 basis points yesterday. So rates have come up just a tick as the stock market has found some footing in here. But it's a situation that's likely to be around for a couple more months if we can use the SARS model, the SARS time frame as any indication of what to expect in the bond market. The decline in rates took us back at one point to where we were last September when there were recession worries out there. And so that was caused a little concern. We also saw the yield curve become flat, which also generates a lot of some headlines and some conversation as to just what the impact on the economy might be from the coronavirus. The Fed met last week. They did not mention anything about the coronavirus specifically. They made an oblique reference talking about the downside risk to the economy. That's always sort of part of their conversation. But they didn't mention the virus specifically, and they took no action, which was expected. But the Fed funds futures market did react pretty decisively, and is now predicting or implying, at least, that the Fed may cut as early as September of this year by 25 basis points. Now, that moves around a lot, depending upon what the news of the day is, but it's a good indication of kind of the general tone in the market as to what the Fed is likely to do going forward. So, as I say, this decline in rates is likely to be around for a couple months. It doesn't look like there's a high likelihood that we're just going to turn around and go back to where we were in the latter part of December, if history has anything to say about it. So it definitely has introduced an element of uncertainty in higher bond prices certainly in the Treasury markets.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Let's switch gears a little bit, and one big news item that I guess the coronavirus has overshadowed was Brexit. We've been talking about this for several years, lots of back and forth leadership changes, a lot of uncertainty on, whether it would actually occur or not, and January 31st, the UK officially left the EU. And in pretty short order, there were a lot of discussions regarding free trade, not only between the UK and the EU, but many other countries as well. And Richard, if you could, maybe kind of bring us up to date on that situation and what's in store as we move forward.
Yes, sure will, Dave. I think a lot of people probably thought the Brexit news stories would go away at January 31st when they finally exited, but that is not going to be the case. It's been very evident immediately, even before the deal was finalized and certainly right after, that this is going to be the negotiations between the EU and the United Kingdom are going to be very tense, and they are immediately posturing and showing no indication of any desire to negotiate or to compromise. The EU is insistent that the United Kingdom must continue to follow their extensive set of rules about environmental treatments, about labor, about fishing rights, and numerous other things and worry that if the United Kingdom does not do that, then that will put the United Kingdom in an advantageous position in making trade deals with other countries around the world. The United Kingdom, Boris Johnson immediately stated that they had no intention of just saying they were going to follow the UK's rules, that they were going to make their own decisions. In some cases, the rules that they set up for themselves may be better, stricter. In some cases, they may not. But that they were going to go their own way. And frankly, Johnson said, if we can't make a deal that we consider a good deal, then we'll be fine economically without the EU's joining us in a free trade deal. And they said they'd be happy with a deal such as the one that the European Union has with Canada and with Australia, which are more geared to World Trade Organization rules, which do involve tariffs between the nations. So, again, not a lot of cooperation evident here. But I want to switch real quickly to the fact that now that the UK is independent of the EU, they are free to make trade deals with any other country. And there's a strong desire by both the UK and the United States to have a free trade agreement now that they're out of the EU. Sort of surprisingly, a number of things have come up that are creating tension between the United Kingdom and the United States. And Mike Pompeo, our Secretary of State, has been discussing these issues with the United Kingdom recently. And they still say lots of nice things to each other about their desire and their belief that they will have a very strong free trade agreement. But the issue of Huawei, the large Chinese telecommunication company, has come up, as well as a digital service tax that the United Kingdom wants to put on our large Internet companies such as Google and Microsoft have gotten in the way. And they're going to be discussing these things at length. But there are some difficulties that have arisen. So I'm going to have no shortage of news going forward to talk about in the world of trade agreements between many different nations and how that might impact the economies. But, again, lots going on there, but I'll leave it at that and turn it back to you, Dave.
Great. All right, Richard, more to come on that. Thank you. Paul, we talked about specifically a little bit more detail around the economic impact of the coronavirus and specifically in China. Let's take that out of the picture if we can. I know you fully can't, but, you know, how does it look in the U.S.? I know we had a pretty good ISM report yesterday, but give us your impressions on how the first quarter is shaping up, and are we still on plan to hit your projected targets for full year 2020?
Well, I think we basically are, as a short version. U.S. economic growth probably continues at a modest rate in 2020, a little slower than 2019. So the final year-to-year growth rate in the fourth quarter data was 2.3%. So we had been projecting a 2 to 2.5% range for 2019, and it came right in there in the middle. So our expectation for 2020 is a little slower, 1.5 to 2%. And we think that the economy is slowing a little bit in the first quarter, independent of China and international considerations, just of its own weight, but probably going to pick up in the second half and end up somewhere in the high end of that 1.5 to 2% range, you know, 1.8, 1.9, 2% sort of trend this year. A little slower than 2019, but still a modestly growing economy. Just breaking it down a little bit, it's interesting to look at sort of a positive and negative ledger, which is pretty well balanced. And that's the main theme for the U.S. economy, I think, today, is that it's pretty well balanced, and it's hard to see, you know, where the recession risk might come from. There's a lot of you know, on the other hands of the discussion, but starting with some of the main positives, at 3.5%, the economy's at full employment, meaning that real disposable personal income is pretty decent. It's slowing a little bit, but it's pretty decent. Wages are growing okay. Housing sector is improving. Consumer confidence is high. On the other hand, real personal consumption spending is slowing. It slowed a lot last year from about 4.5% to 2% rate. Capital spending has slowed a lot. As a result of the trade war. As we mentioned earlier, the coronavirus deflates confidence at exactly a bad time, offsetting some of the benefits of the Phase One trade deal. Back on the positive side, quantitative easing is back. The European Central Bank is trying to gin up quantitative easing. They haven't done a lot yet. It's not been very aggressive, but they're moving in that direction. The U.S. Fed put $400 billion on its balance sheet in the fourth quarter under the name of smoothing out volatility in the repo market. But under the if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. It looks a lot like quantitative easing in the U.S. Our expectation is that it's not nearly as aggressive as the heyday, if you will, in 2014, 15, 16, where global central banks were pumping out about $2 trillion a year collectively. It looks like at best, about half of that, and some of that may roll off if the Fed is true to their word that it's really not quantitative easing. But to the extent it's there, it does keep interest rates low, punishes savers, it disrupts capital spending cycles, and diminishes dynamism in the economy. The economy is just not responsive to various incentives. On the positive side, again, inventories are low. There was a big inventory runoff in the fourth quarter, so that is potentially a boost for U.S. manufacturing to kind of restock. On the other hand, the dollar is strong, and while that the positive aspect of that gives the Fed flexibility to cut interest rates if they think they need to support global economy, it does suppress manufacturing activity. So a mix of factors for U.S. manufacturing, mostly problematic. On the positive side, corporate earnings growth is improving. However, equity valuations are high. So that means that cost of capital for corporations is low. That's good for them, but it's a caution flag for investors with high valuations. So basically, the U.S. economy appears relatively balanced. There's no obvious bubbles or problem sectors that appear to be being driven by artificial stimulus or incentives in one way or another. It's a relatively balanced economy. On the other hand, it's 11 years old, this cycle is, and at full employment, and which means that the potential for a growth spurt is low. And finally, there has been a resurgence in debt use by corporations and the federal government to fairly substantial levels. We had a deleveraging cycle following 2008, but that chapter is over and closed, and leverage is back, which carries a price. It suppresses growth. Lots of assets, lots of capital is devoted to debt service rather than productive investment. So, again, a growth suppressant there. So, again, bottom line, it looks like a continued modest growth economy this year with low recession risk.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Greg, let's wrap it up with a discussion around equities. I think one thing, like Brexit was overshadowed, so was some pretty good earnings reports in the fourth quarter, or I should say in January reporting earnings for the fourth quarter. Give us an update on earnings and then just a general outlook on stocks, if you could.
Why not end on a somewhat positive note? Earnings season's in full swing, and just about half of the companies in the S&P 500 have reported actual results for Q4 2019. And the positive aspect is of those companies, 69% are reporting that they are above estimates, which we, of course, refer to as a positive earnings surprise, which is generally quite good for stocks. Now, I will put that in a little bit of perspective. I think coming into 2020, there was a lot of negative expectations. I think, the outlook in terms of global slowing, although I had previously mentioned it seemed like perhaps we were bottoming out, but I think perhaps somewhat cynically you can make an argument that earnings expectations were adjusted downward pretty dramatically by analysts. So the bar that we're kind of using to measure those earnings reports are it's not that hard to beat, I think. So I don't want to, knock it too much, but I think we also have to keep things in perspective that typically analysts are quite optimistic coming into the new year, and they reduce their earnings, but I think we came into this year with kind of lower expectations. So we're really seeing, as you point out, reasonably good performance on the earnings front. But not only are earnings are good, companies are reporting top-line growth as well. Sales reports are coming in at almost 1% above estimates, so that's also a positive, which, would consequently lead to better earnings. But hopefully that trend continues, and that should help the markets going forward. I think investors are counting on stronger earnings growth, and as Paul pointed out, I think they're looking for that in the second half, that perhaps things are particularly going to expand once we make it through this. And again, assuming that we can kind of put coronavirus behind us, we didn't have, although it could change this year, last year earnings were driven by what we call multiple expansion or PE expansion in price earnings ratios, along with, of course, Fed rate cuts. Given what Jeff just mentioned about a possible cut, so that could add a little stimulus to the economy. So I think right now, I think there's a good chance that we'll have a positive year. Maybe not as good as last year, but certain things are in place, as Paul said, that it's pretty well balanced at this point.
All right. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today, and we look forward to speaking with you again on March 3rd. Thank you.